Welcome to the second hour of Love Babs Love Talk. I'm Babs Rawls Ivy, and this is Love Babs Love Talk. I'm so delighted because guess who's back to talk about, they were on, I guess a few months ago, Michael Van Lesten and Earl Bloodworth, who we all know Earl Bloodworth because he's my fraternity brother and he's an activist and does a lot of reentry stuff. And I think you're still doing that for Bridgeport properly, right?
Properly, yes.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, some of us are active in these streets and some of us are activists in municipal spaces, trying to do the right thing, help people do the right thing. So I appreciate y'all. So the last time we talked, the last time y'all were here, you were talking about this fund that was created. Michael Van Lesten, talk a little bit about that before we talk about who got the award?
Sure. So the short version is that we at Social Venture Partners, we decided to start a participatory grant making pilot, which is basically we raised money internally from the Social Venture Partners. There are about 220 of them now, but we raised about several hundred thousand dollars from about 40 individuals. And with the idea of forming a committee of individuals like Earl, who had very deep experience working in communities as the decision makers as to where the money would go. So they're deciding sort of the resource allocation. And there are a lot of reasons why we did this. One of them was that we believe that this type of decision making because we simply have a more informed group of decision makers. So Earl's going to know the space in Bridgeport and New Haven far better than say I would, even though I've been a resident of New Haven for 25 years. So with that, we raised the $200,000 and then we decided to make unrestricted grants of $25,000 each to people of color run organizations that are doing work to affect systemic change. So the example I gave in the last show was that direct service would be funding a bail fund. Systems change work would be working to change the bail system so that you ultimately wouldn't need bail funds or as many bail funds. And there are other examples that the committee worked on and provided to potential grantees. And we can talk about that further if you like.
Okay. No, keep going.
Oh, okay. So we got these seven individuals together. And honestly, from my perspective, I was pretty amazed. It was an awesome experience for me because I was not a decision maker. I simply watched them as they went through their analysis and vetting of each of the 59 applications. One of the things I'd like to point out is that we did get many more applications than we had anticipated. And being on your show and Tom Ficklin's show and Nance Kingwood's show, and there was a Facebook Live event with the joint venture between the Bridgeport Public Library and the New Haven Free Public Library, where Earl and I were on there for a couple of hours. And that was this, and those shows were our outreach. And we got a really strong response from a lot of amazing organizations. I really wish we'd had $5 million because there were a lot of really amazing organizations. The other thing that it did was, for me personally, it allowed me, between the selection of the committee, we reached out to 60 people, 28 responded with interest in becoming committee members, and we interviewed every single one of them and narrowed it down to the seven that we had. The other thing that was really important was for us, Social Venture Partners as an organization, is that it exposed us, it gave us exposure to and the potential to work with any and all of these organizations. So thus far, I've reached out to, well, we reached out to dozens of organizations, had dozens of conversations with organizations before the grant was due, because we opened it up and said, if you had any questions, please just give me a call. Half hour, 45 minute, hour long conversations with potential grantees. And so that started something. And then afterwards, thus far, I've had conversations with and done some work with about 15 organizations so far. So sometimes it's advice in helping them with their development work and raising money. Sometimes it's strategy. There's a lot of strategic discussions going on. And also sometimes what I found was with not only with the nominees for the grant making committee, but also with the organizations who applied for the grant, there are people out there doing a tremendous amount of work in a given space. It might be mental health, it might be with the reentry population, it might be workforce development, but they don't actually know each other. So they're not pooling their resources or even connecting in a way where both parties would benefit. And so I've been sort of a connector sometimes for organizations. And then lastly, I would say that this process that we went through is definitely changing the way we do our own nonprofit partnerships at Social Venture Partners. So we have a number of people of color run organizations that have applied directly to Social Venture Partners as part of our workflow. And I'm hoping that some of them will become partners shortly in the next month or two, and we'll have more to talk about.
Wow. So you had a lot of applicants. Mm-hmm. From your press release, you said you got about 59 of them.
Yeah.
And then you narrowed it down to
seven. Eight.
So, and just looking at this list, it looks very vast and broad.
It was.
Like, so there was no, like, you didn't focus on one sort of thing. So it looks as though you just looked at a broad spectrum and said, you know what, this feels good, this feels right. I mean, I don't know. What was that process like?
Yeah, there's a lot of people out there doing a lot of good work. And it was great being a part of this process. I don't know if I said this to Michael. I remember him first approaching me about this, and he was like, yeah, we gotta, you know, we'll talk about doing some impact work in the community and providing, you know, direct funding to people doing the grassroots work. Little did I know, this was like building an airplane and flying it at the same time and going through a lot of process work to understand, you know, more than I thought I understood, like systemic issues and systemic racism and how, you know, the system has this baked in thing that kind of marginalizes people. And when we put the word out and we did these various outreach through your show, through Tom Ficklin, in partnership with the Bridgeport and New Haven Public Libraries, and we got all these people that were doing work on various levels of this systemic issue, trying to impact. And a lot of people doing work on a shoestring budget or just funding it out of their own pockets and just really, you know, nose to the grindstone, grassroots work. So it was amazing. I wish, like Michael said, we had more money to give out to like the over 59 people or organizations that applied.
So what are the ranges of the awards? Does everybody get the same amount or?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. There were 8 awards of $25,000.
Whoa. That makes a huge difference. I mean, having someone who has run nonprofits and run grassroots organizations, $25,000 makes a huge damn difference.
That was the point. Okay. Exactly, because a lot of times
playing around, you didn't get $1,000.
Exactly, a lot of times grassroots organizations, there's this circular argument that's often made in the philanthropy world where they'll say, "Oh well, we're not going to give you this money because you don't have the capacity." But then, how do you get capacity? How do you build capacity without money? Mm-hmm. So it's like this circular argument that keeps these organizations underfunded. Yeah. The other thing that happens is that oftentimes these organizations really have in insight and inroads into communities and connections with people who are definitely the most vulnerable and oftentimes have least reason to trust institutions because of how they've been treated their entire lives. And so that these organizations bring because they know what's going on right at the grassroots, right at the level of the community, that a lot of philanthropies and a lot of institutions in our state simply don't have. And the other thing is, they are also comprised of individuals who have not a 2-year commitment or a 5-year commitment or to their work. This work is their calling. They have a lifelong commitment to their community. There are people who I've spoken to who have been working on various issues in their communities for 40, 50 years. People get into their 70s and early 80s when you think most people would be retired. And in fact, they're still committed to working for and with their communities. And so I consider that a powerful asset, because that powerful asset engenders trust from people in the communities that they're trying to serve. And I'm hoping that this will in some small way spur some recognition of that as an asset organization in the work that they do.
Let's talk about some of let's run through the list of these folks because I'm just so impressed. Sure. So first one up is Cheer Institute, which addresses racial, ethnic health inequities caused by racism. I mean, okay.
So I actually had I've had a recent conversation with Dr. Naraja Staggers Lee, who she's a PhD who is a professor at a community college up in Springfield, Massachusetts, but she's based in Connecticut. And basically the attraction, Earl was on the committee that made the decision to select her. But I'm saying this is my personal opinion, but Earl can speak to this as well. I saw them as a really, really neat organization because they're teaching advocacy skills. How do you self-advocacy? So it's not just you're not a victim. There are things that you can do to affect policy and a legislation.
And they're doing it in the healthcare.
In the health sector.
Where people need to be their own advocates.
Absolutely.
My producer and I were talking about this earlier about, you get in the doctor's office or you get into the health, for whatever reason you enter for care, it can be overwhelming and you don't know how to maneuver those waters.
Yeah, it's definitely daunting. I've met Dr. Raja multiple times. I first met her back in, I want to say 2015. She was working in public health and I was up at the state capitol, very vested in reducing the health gap and providing people with a sense of self-agency. So that was very appealing. And you don't need to go very far to understand the impact of, the advocacy work to decrease the health gap, health equity gap. Just looking at the past year and the pandemic and who the pandemic or any of the last few things that health-wise impacted the nation, it impacted the Black and Brown communities more so than anybody else. Mm-hmm. Similarly, with those folks that are coming out of prison and reentry, while Black Browns are definitely highly impacted by hypertension and environmental racism, diabetes, all these different things, increased mortality and morbidity in the Black and Brown community, that is even the rates are even higher in those that are in entry coming out of prison. So that information about continuity of care, being an advocate for yourself, knowing where to go for information, and not being afraid to ask your doctor for what it is that you feel that you need.
Mm-hmm. Good.
There's a lot of information out there as far as, and I don't know if you saw recently, there's a new documentary called Black Men in White Coats.
Yes.
I watched it with my wife, who's a physician, and it's interesting when you hear about just those little things about how we talk and different body languages that unfortunately some Caucasian physicians, they won't understand it, they'll miss. And they may mistake that for an individual being resistant to the treatment plan, or it may be just a miscommunication. So having that interface and having somebody like Raja doing the work she does, advocating on at a higher level and in grassroots level, is very beneficial to the community.
All right. So the Connecticut NAACP, which is still led by Scott X.
Yep.
Okay. I understand this. This makes sense to me. I know the good work that they do. And I think this
further on multiple fronts.
On multiple fronts, and this further helps them further their work across Connecticut proper.
Mm-hmm. Especially one of the big things that they're working on right now, too, as a pilot in the state of Connecticut, that is hopefully going to be duplicated throughout the nation, is their Million Jobs campaign, which is a focus on a lot of the industries that we have here in manufacturing and health, and employing up to 10,000 individuals that are formerly incarcerated.
Okay. And the Connecticut Students for a Dream, I don't know this organization, focuses on empowering students and educators to destigmatize immigration. Oh, I do know this organization.
Yeah, it was founded several years ago by two undocumented twins from Brazil who ended up, they started it as a very small, even to call it an organization. I was just speaking to one of them is to say a lot, but basically it grew into this effort to basically make it so that, undocumented students could get financial aid at colleges in the state. At state colleges anyway, and universities. And basically they've been very, very effective. One of the things that is really important in recognizing that systems change is a multi-year effort, that it takes time, it's a grind, right? And so you need capacity building funding in order to maintain the fight, because there's very little systems change that happens in a year. Or if you see it happen and it seems like it all of a sudden happened, well, there was 10 years of work behind it. So they had been very, very effective in that, and they still continue in their advocacy work. And again, like Cheer Institute, again, they're promoting self-advocacy. So it's not just about trying to help people. It's trying to help people, trying to get it so people know how to help themselves. They have an understanding of the system and how they can advocate within that system. So, that's what I thought was really interesting about that organization.
East End NRZ Pop-Up Marketing Cafe provides residents to access to healthy food, job opportunities, and a local gathering place to build neighborhood cohesion.
Mm-hmm. You'll find there are a lot. So you have sort of like neighborhood town committees. And basically what they did is they formalized it, and they started having people understand how to advocate for themselves. You know, there's a lot in talking about gentrification, and there are things that folks can do to deter gentrification and take more control and empower themselves around their community. So, if you don't want this business in your community, they show you how to advocate and legislate with the city council and who to speak to in your municipality, as well as providing opportunities and outlets for employment and providing food in the food business. So,
I would add that in one statistic that was kind of mind blowing is that there's a certain point you can stand in the East End of Bridgeport, and the nearest supermarket's 8 miles away. The nearest pharmacy's 4 miles away, which is prohibitive unless you have your own transportation. And even then, that's still amazing. And so they provide it's something as simple as fresh vegetables, healthy food. Like one of the reasons why the Black and Brown communities have, relatively speaking, poorer health is lack of access to healthy food, as opposed to processed food.
Yeah.
So
processed food stays on the shelf longer. I just had somebody
from
New Haven food service policy folks on the other day.
Yeah.
Talking about just that kind of thing.
Who's that, Latha?
Yeah, Latha.
Oh, she's awesome.
And Jennifer Acosta.
Okay.
So they're addressing, it's very interesting. Like a lot of these organizations are addressing multiple systems. They're not addressing just one thing, because you can't just address one thing.
Right.
Because there's no one thing. If you try to change only one thing, it's like squeezing Jell-O. Yeah. You just don't, you know, it's messy no, and it doesn't work.
I mean, oftentimes things are interconnected. I mean,
yes,
you cannot exactly. talk about housing and not talk about job opportunities. You cannot exactly. talk about reentry without talking about healthcare or housing or childcare. I mean, everything is very interconnected. So
very much so.
Yes.
Okay. My personal favorite, Elm City Lit Fest. I know these folks mm-hmm. personally. Ife Gardeen is my dear friend. And I was so delighted to hear that she got this because, you know, she has a passion for community and a passion for all things literary. So, and then she has turned this Lit Fest into a podcast, into almost cult movement-like kind of vibe, right? Like people really embrace this. So talk to me about why you chose this organization.
I have to be fair. I did not. I stayed away from this one particular just out of conflict of interest. I know these people very well. I wasn't on that particular board and looked at them and interviewed them and went to the site visit. But I had my hand up when anybody would like to say anything about possibly not having them involved.
I'm in the process of having conversations with them right now. And one of the things that really got me excited, I kept a blank face and tried not to introduce any of my bias or anything or my opinions into this process. But I was praying that they picked Elm City Lit Fest because I'm an avid reader. And
me too. I would have been like a cheerleader, like, no, you got to pick them.
I was speaking to them. Well, the cream always rises to the top. So, but I was speaking to the folks at Elm City Lit Fest the other day, and I said, I mentioned Octavia. I heard a podcast about Octavia Butler and the why fiction matters, why literature matters. And literature matters because it's an expression of the human imagination of things being a different way. So you can start to envision. And so when you see literature written about yourself and people like yourself, especially as a child or even an adult, you can see, oh, that's a possibility. So literature is more about possibilities in the human imagination. It's not just, oh, isn't that a nice little story? I mean, that I often say that's why, you know, like the Bible is full of stories. It's not full of like a list of rules, it's stories because that's human beings Testament. Need stories, right? So exactly. So, but, and there were others too, but other holy books too. But the bottom line is that's what I thought was really compelling because it speaks to change that around mindset change. How do you change people's thinking about themselves? Right. Well, this is one of the means, and I thought it was a really neat organization.
No, that's a good one. And they're new, and to get such an award, a grant is it just speaks to the kind of work that they do, and how this is so necessary. That someone said, you know what, I like this. Let me fund this. So thank you. I know them personally, so I can say that. But Mount Airy Baptist Church, which is one of my favorite places to go. I don't go often, but I love the work that they do up over there.
Yeah, Reverend Pastor Bennett is amazing.
And his wife is my sorority sister. So I feel some kind of way about that already. But I've been in their church. I've been in their presence. I've served on some things with him. I mean, that church is amazing. So what made you think of, because there's a bunch of churches you could have picked. I mean, they're not the only ones that are doing amazing work.
They just have a compelling story with all the different levels of systems that they are approaching to counteract on the behalf of the community that they serve. You have Pastor Bennett leading, one of the leaders of the Connect organization, which is a big proponent and pusher for the Clean Slate legislation. You know, they host the Black Wall Street program every year on their grounds. They do an inordinate amount of amazing work in the community to uplift folks and let them know that things are possible. So not only do they feed people physically, they also feed people spiritually. So. I can't say enough about the amazing work that Pastor Bennett is doing, has been doing for years.
they touch a lot of points in the system, and they're organized about it. And you know, it's very compelling on that basis.
Mm-hmm. Good. PT Partners. I don't think I know this one, but it's a grassroots, resident-led community organizing nonprofit aiming to rebuild opportunity in the PT Barnum Apartments, a low-income public housing development in Bridgeport. Mm-hmm. This is interesting because this is right at the heart of housing, I think.
So it's an amazing intersection of the stuff that they're doing, from just trying to maintain the whole thing together throughout the pandemic and COVID, you know, trying to make sure that residents still have access to a community room, doing all types of things to help the individuals that reside in PT Barnum. And I don't know if you know the history of the, you know, the housing projects here in Bridgeport, PT Barnum and Father Panic Village.
Yes.
You know, they're some harsh environments to live in. To have this like basically a beacon of hope shining through, helping individuals find their way with different things, connect them to advocacy through, you know, the city council. Again, providing food out of healthy and nutritious food out of a food desert, diaper bank, all the stuff right there where people can access it, you know, meeting the people where they're at and what they need. Again, like all the other organizations, they're building people in an organization and train them and build them up so they can advocate for themselves and then teach other people as well. So,
and the other interesting thing about it is that it's a very flat organization. So it's not like there's just one leader who's kind of like a cult of personality leading them all the way. What it is it's very flat organizationally, and they're a community that makes decisions about their community. They've even worked, in terms of their advocacy work, they've changed the way resources get allocated to even do the repairs and maintenance on the buildings in the projects. Like, that was one of their original driving rationale for creating this thing, was that the housing was dilapidated, and you need resources to repair and maintain this stuff. And so they basically are really in a place where there wasn't community. And I can't say wasn't community, but there wasn't organized community. Mm-hmm. There was always community, but there wasn't organized community. All of a sudden, understanding that community actually is an asset, and if you organize it properly, you can get a lot of things done and collectively be much better off. And so that's what they did. So that's why they were so compelling.
And last but not least, the Sickle Cell Disease Association of America of Southern Connecticut. Is this Jim Rawlings and crew?
It is.
That's our Jim.
Yes.
That's right.
We go way back. I mean, he really was the catalyst for me doing the AIDS work back in the late 80s, early 90s. Like, he really was the catalyst and inspired me to go and do that work, because he was like, history is going to ask, where were you? And that just meant so much to me that I went and started volunteering and then ultimately started working for the AIDS Project New Haven. So they just built a house. They just renovated, built a house for Michelle's, I think it's Michelle's house, right?
Yeah, Michelle's house, correct.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, what was compelling about that? I mean, sickle cell is very unique to Black people. We don't hear enough about it. I don't know if we ever raise enough money for it. And I think it's good that at least we're finally starting to say we can eradicate this.
You just answered the question that you were just asking. quite honestly. And then, not to mention that, you know, he has a broad spectrum of support between New Haven and Bridgeport, and doing the work that he's doing. And, you know, a major thing during his tenure as head of the NAACP in New Haven, you know, he forged along and created, you know, a health equity gap report that is still useful to this day, just to highlight the disparity in health outcomes for Black and Brown communities.
And speaking to him, his family and my family go way back, because he's originally from Rhode Island. So he knew my dad, my late father, really well, and his mother and my father knew each There's a long, beautiful story to all of that because my dad, but so it's really fun. So I've had many more conversations with Jim, and this was another organization. I was like, please let them select this. Please let them select this. But I didn't say anything. A couple of things about sickle cell. The first thing is that there are diseases that have literally one third as many people suffering from them that have 10 times as much funding for finding a cure. Now, I'm not going to be in politics and name those diseases because the people suffering from those diseases are suffering badly. But there is a definite relative underfunding of sickle cell in the medical research community. Flip side, there's a very, very poor understanding or insufficient understanding of the disease, even within the Black community. So it's tough for us to advocate. We don't even know like how many people it's really affecting and how it affects them. So one of the things that he's focused on is making sure with African descent who have sickle cell trait and sickle cell disease are better educated about the disease and the trait and better educated about what the outcomes are for people who have this. Because one of the things that happens is the relative societal ignorance of the disease really, for instance, detrimentally affects students who suffer from this because they miss a lot of school. And then if people don't really understand what they're going through, it just looks like, the kid's not coming to school and, you know, is basically truant or the parents aren't taking it. Like there's a real lack of understanding of how this can really, really significantly affect a significant number of people in our state. So he's really focused on that. And again, what I found attractive about his process was, yes, it's underfunded and so forth, but he's focused on, but what can we do now as a people in terms of our own self-advocacy, our own self-education about it? Because if we're not advocating for it and we don't have an education about it, how would we expect anybody else to, right? Yeah. So you gotta lead the way. And so that's what I find compelling about what he's doing. How he's approaching it, and I'm really glad that the committee saw fit to fund them.
Now it's not just about educating our folks in our community, but it's also educating you know the medical establishment, because you have some of these, you know, in mm-hmm. our community we have teacher schools, you know, you got Yale basically overseeing everything, and that's a teaching institute. So you have students that are in their residency going to that institution, and they may not have encountered anybody with sickle cell or understand it. And so when you have that interaction, they may think, oh, this person's just pain pill searching, or, you know, there's nothing really wrong with them. I can really tell. They don't know how to necessarily treat it. So educating the medical staff as well is a big thing that he's a proponent of as well.
So, all right, so you all have given out these awards. So what do you do now? Are you fast and furiously raising more money to do this all over again? And when are you going to do it all over again? And we got like 2 minutes.
Okay. So we're working on phase two right now, and we'll have more information about exactly what we plan to do as an organization with this. My inclination is to wrap it into what we do on a daily basis. In other words, not keep it as a separate initiative, but incorporate it into the culture and work that we do at Social Venture Partners. And more to come on that.
Okay. Well, then you have to come back and talk about the more to come part, because I want this to stay in the hearts and minds of our community that this is happening. I had Reverend Orsella Hughes on the other day, and she is the president of the Prosperity Foundation, and so I just see, you know, y'all on one side and them on the other side, and our community, you know, can, you know, have opportunities to sort of continue to do the work that they do. So you got to come back and give me the phase two conversation.
Always a pleasure to do that.
I so appreciate this, and I will run this in the inner city. If you have some pictures of folks, send them along, Earl. If you got some pictures, if not, I'll just find some of some of these folks. But
sure, we can work that out.
I want to run this, and if you get it to me, you know, in the next couple of days, I can run it for next week. Because I think the community ought to know that you know, more of the community ought to know of this good work and what y'all have done so far. So thank you, Michael Van Leesten, and Earl Bloodworth for being my guest this morning. So it's a
thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Come back.
Sure thing.
More stuff to talk about, I'm sure, Babs.
Oh, you know, you're welcome here anytime. So,
hey, something back. You should keep on your radar is the Unite CT. That's some funding for individuals that are behind in their rent or need to get help to maintain keeping their rent so they don't become homeless. A lot of work being done on that in both communities. And unfortunately, the word has not gotten out. I know specifically in New Haven, only about 10 people have applied for the funding. So
All right, I definitely will help support that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Maybe I can get them on and they can talk about that. So y'all have a good weekend and I will see y'all in these social justice streets.
All right, take care.
Thank you. All right, Harry. I know you're hovering to play me out.
Hi, this is Babs Rawls Ivy from New Haven, Connecticut, and you're listening to WNHHLP 103.5 FM, streaming live at newhavenconnecticut.org.